the content of this program is intended for the blind and print impaired audience. This is Avery Lewis from NC Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Ebony and Essence magazines. The first article is titled, Juneteenth and National New Beginnings. Soldiers, all of a sudden, was everywhere, coming in bunches, crossing and walking and riding. Everyone was a-singing. We was all walking on golden clouds. Hallelujah! Hallelujah! This is how Felix Haywood recalled the arrival of Brigadier General Gordon Granger as he rode into Galveston, Texas, with his troops on June 19, 1865. Granger announced General Orders No. 3, declaring that in accordance with a proclamation from the Executive of the United States, all slaves are free. Haywood described the fervor of fellow African Americans. Everybody went wild. We all felt like heroes, and nobody had made us that way but ourselves. We was free. Just like that, we was free. The crowd's glee would quickly dissipate as the sober reality set in that the order would require significant force to implement. It would take months for those enslaved in the interior of the state to get the word, and a full year before all could publicly celebrate the demolition of the last Confederate holdout. Starting in 1866, that day of Jubilee will become a festive annual occasion for political speeches and church sermons extolling the virtues of good citizenship duties and rights, accompanied by music and food. Since the 1890s, the day has been called Juneteenth, an abbreviation of June 19th. Granger's announcement was a remarkable event, though noteworthy for the coming late and being ferociously resisted. Lincoln had issued the Emancipation Proclamation, which ended slavery in the Confederate States, which were still in rebellion in January of 1863. In truth, very few people were freed as the proclamation applied mainly to those places where federal authority had been nullified. But the prospects for freedom were least likely to be achieved, and the westernmost state of the Confederacy that had escaped much military penetration. Its isolation made it a haven for slaveholders from Louisiana, Mississippi, Arkansas, and Missouri seeking refuge when their own states were invaded. The reins of slavery were tightened even more in the Lone Star State, as they were losing their grip and deteriorating elsewhere in the South. From the beginning of the war, women, men, and children ran away to the Union lines in droves. Many of the rest left behind on plantations turned them into unruly sites of de facto liberty. And Black men enlisted as soldiers in the U.S. military in large numbers after Lincoln's proclamation. Robert E. Lee's surrender at Appomattox on April 9, 1865, put the final nail in the coffin of bondage, enabling Lincoln's promissory note to be realized in most places, but not in Texas. While some slaveholders conceded to Granger's announcement immediately, many others refused. Confederate soldiers returned home in uniforms, armed, and ready to retaliate with violence against Black people who dared to exercise their new rights. According to testimony in hearings conducted by the Joint Committee on Reconstruction in Congress, gruesome events like the following were a commonplace. An officer of a U.S. Colored Troops regiment testified that Lucy Grimes was taken into the woods by two men and there stripped and beaten until she died. She had enraged Mrs. Grimes, the woman who formerly claimed to be her owner. Lucy refused to whip her own child, who had been falsely accused of stealing money. Mrs. Grimes then sent for two men to fetch Lucy. They bruised her naked body with multiple strikes by a whip and crushed her skull with a club. Other black people were lynched, bodies hung on trees for the crime of fleeing to freedom. White Texans rejected the legitimacy of emancipation so violently, hoping that slavery would be restored, or at least the federal government would compensate them for the loss of wealth and human chattel. As historian Elizabeth Hayes Turner has argued, the war may not have brought a great deal of bloodshed to Texas, but the peace certainly did. White allies in the federal government also reigned on the parade of black freedom in Texas. Granger's order included caveats and warnings. The freed men are advised to remain quietly at their present homes and work for rate wages. They are informed that they will not be allowed to collect at military post, and that they will not be supported in idleness, either there or elsewhere. Federal agents were as much concerned about maintaining social order among blacks and restoring the plantation economy as were in finalizing the war. Granger was either unaware or unmoved by black genius and valor on and off the battlefields that had disproven dreaded fears of dependency. Instead, he urged black Texans to sit tight and not to prioritize pulling their families back together that had been broken apart, and above all, get back to work under the same management. The history of how emancipation came to be in Texas in 1865 was convoluted and the road ahead was unknowable. But African Americans like Haywood focused on the remarkable feat of what they had already achieved after centuries of enslavement. As Texans moved along the grid patterns of the Great Migration in the 20th century, they carried their celebrations of freedom along with the hopes of engendered for securing full citizenship rights. Juneteenth is now marked in nearly every state and even in some places abroad. Juneteenth has always been a reminder about the larger meaning of the Civil War. The Democratic promise of Reconstruction that was cut short in the aftermath and the reinforcement of Democratic values, however circumscribed. As W.E. Du Bois remarked in his magisterial study, Black Reconstruction, the slave went free, stood a brief moment in the sun, then moved back again towards slavery. It is that forward movement and backwards again pattern that has dogged the realization of racial equality that we are grappling with once again. This year's commemoration is especially poignant in the midst of an unprecedented multiracial, multigenerational insurgent social justice movement. The videotape incident of police officers crushing and suffocating a subdued George Floyd sparked the fires, but many other forms of racial inequality have come under attack. Confederate monuments are once again being toppled by protesters or taken down by officials because they are symbols of a lost cause ideology that flagrantly touts white supremacy through the funds raised to erect them by the likes of the Ku Klux Klan, in the inscriptions carved in steel and stone, and in the bigoted speeches given at their dedications long after the war was over. We will never be at peace as a nation as long as false idols to history are allowed to stand, and we will fail to reckon with the truth of slavery and its stubborn legacies in attitudes, practices, and policies that live on today. Juneteenth is the sign of a new beginning. It marked the second founding at its inception in 1866 as a renewal of the declarations and commitments made at the first founding that has never been fully squared. We are at another crossroads in the nation. The direction we choose to take at the ballot box, in the streets, in the boardrooms, in places of worship, in the mom and pop shops, in schools, in police stations, in governmental bodies at all levels, in our healthcare institutions, and in media will determine the extent and shape of democracy for coming generations. Long may the struggle persevere until justice for all prevails. Dr. Tara W. Hunter is professor of history and African American studies at Princeton University. She is a scholar of labor, gender, race, and Southern history. The next article is titled, How Beauty Entrepreneur Angela C. Stiles Made a Way with No Blueprint. Raising money as an entrepreneur isn't a straightforward or glamorous as it often appears on social media. Serial entrepreneur and Emmy Award-winning beauty industry vet Angela C. Stiles has learned how to navigate the vast world of funding her entrepreneurial dreams better than most and earlier in life than many. In her latest Unbossed podcast episode, she breaks down her story and the financial know-how she gained on the fly to make her dreams come true. The moment that I knew I wanted to be in the beauty industry was probably at some point when I was a child. I've always loved hair. Most people like to go to Toys R Us when they were a kid. I like to go to the beauty supply. I knew that was my calling, Angela reminisces. As far as becoming an entrepreneur, I think that something I had to realize was a part of pursuing my passion, but it's not something that they, as in the educational spaces around cosmetology, they don't really put entrepreneurship in the same conversation. And so you don't really realize you have to be a full entrepreneur until you're like, it's okay, I'm getting this money. Now, how do I brand myself? How do I do that? Now I need an account. Now I need so on and so on. And so it's one of those things that's just kind of happens. And then you've decided to put the jacket on and say, all right, this is who I am. Early and quickly, Angela learned the importance of maintaining healthy credit and the diligence and persistence needed to apply and receive grants and loans as a beauty entrepreneur. Credit has been probably one of the most beneficial things to my brand, and I've had the pleasure of generating a lot of capital through work. So I've used having credit and then also being able to build and generate my own capital to help that and grow the business. With a bevy of beloved stars from Eve to Beyonce on her roster of clients, an Instagram following of over 100,000, and a constantly evolving niche skill set, she's mastered pivoting in uncertain times to meet clients' needs in the beauty space. I have a hairline called Conscious Curls, so I was selling and retailing wigs through that. I was also challenging customers who already had hair extensions to just send those to me, and I could make wigs out of it, just being resourceful in that way. You can hear the full episode of Essence Podcast Network's Unbossed on Apple's Podcast, Spotify, or anywhere you listen to podcasts. The next article is titled, National Urban League Wraps Legislative Policy Conference. The National Urban League, one of the nation's largest civil rights organizations, wrapped its 17th annual legislative policy conference earlier this week. The conference, which brought together top Black thought leaders, elected officials, corporate executive advocates, and activists, was produced digitally for the first time due to the corona pandemic. The confab drew members of the Urban League movement, leaders and staff from 90 affiliates and volunteer affinity groups nationwide to share their thoughts and concerns with the nation's movers and shakers. The gathering took on a new urgency with the triple crisis facing our communities: COVID-19, economic collapse, and racial-motivated police violence, said Mark H. Morrell, president of the National Urban League, NUL, and former mayor of New Orleans. Topics range from conversations about the NUL's legislative and policy initiatives aimed to protect generations of progress in the Black community to a session called Stop Killing Us, The Path to Police Accountability, which tackles its senseless loss of Black lives to police violence, the aftermath of sustained protest, and the path toward transformative social justices. The aftermath of sustained protest and the path toward transformative social justice policies. The conference was produced in partnership with Verizon, and supporting partners included T-Mobile, Lilly, Lyft, Wells Fargo, and Walmart. The next article, Cost of Inaction, Why We Mourn, Why We March, and Why We Fight. A police officer's knee pressing down on a Black body. This is not foreign to me. George Floyd's horrific murder was far too familiar. As a young Black girl growing up in the Bronx, New York, I have lived this horrifying reality many times. In 2013, I was under the weight of a police officer's knee while being arrested. They charged me with two felonies for trying to defend a young person who was being beaten by the police. After 8 long months, the trial ended with my acquittal, but the verdict brought me no peace. Memories of my experience and that of far too many others are permanently burned into my consciousness. I live with the reality that luck, not justice, saved my life. It is a different kind of pain when your nation is comfortable playing Russian roulette with your life and the lives of people who look like you. That is the grief that Black people are carrying right now and have carried for the last 400 years. It doesn't lift. The weight of that grief is heavier right now when, in the middle of this pandemic that disproportionately kills Black people, we have to take to the streets to manually move the wheels of justice for Black people murdered by police and vigilantes. It has been 155 years since the last enslaved people in the United States found out they were free. That was more than 2.5 years after the Emancipation Proclamation made it official, and there is still a devaluing and dehumanizing price tag on Black bodies. This is why we mourn. It is time to make sure future generations don't have to mourn or march the way we do. Structural, systemic, state-sanctioned violence against Black people must end. All violence against all Black people must end. Violence at the hands of the police, violence inflicted by a corrupt criminal justice system, violence in the form of gross negligence against Black essential workers employed as domestic and fast food employees and in other jobs that do not provide adequate social distancing or personal protective equipment. Violence that is the result of systems and structures that have intentionally siphoned economic, health, housing, educational, and other resources away from our communities and left them vulnerable. Violence against cisgendered, transgendered, and queer Black people that is sustained by patriarchy. Violence that separates Black immigrant families through detention and deportation. Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, Tony McDade, George Floyd, Nina Pop, Rayshard Brooks, and countless other murders were the result of converging, compounding, intersectional identities that our nation has deemed dangerous, delinquent, deviant, and devoid of worth for centuries. It is time to close the book on this history. We want a future where Black people are free and our communities flourish. This is why we march. Our beautiful, massive global protest in all 50 states and in cities around the world is a call to a black future where we not only survive, but thrive. We don't simply demand the righting of one wrong. We demand an imaging of a new world. What is broken must be rebuilt, not reformed. We have an opportunity to cut spending for police forces that make up colossal portions of city budgets and reinvest those funds in a safety infrastructure collaboratively created with us. We demand an investment in our wellness, state-of-the-art healthcare, educational opportunities, great jobs that support families, and good, affordable housing. We demand a new way of righting wrongs that is deeply grounded in our humanity. We march carrying the heavy load of grief, purpose, and responsibility, knowing that when you carry any load long enough, you grow stronger. Global protests are swelling with solidarity because our ancestors and freedom fighters were right. No one will truly be free in America unless Black people are free. We are growing strong enough to sustain the fight for real change. We carry forward our lost and their legacy. We carry forward the fight. We march to make the road to the future we want and deserve. We march for nothing short of liberation. At last. T. McHarris is a strategist with the Movement for Black Lives. The Movement for Black Lives is a national network of over 150 leaders and organizations creating a broad political home for Black people to learn, organize, and take action. The next article is titled, Three Reasons to Watch New Go-Go Documentary Called The Beat Don't Stop. Music has long been the soundtrack of protest, and the current time is no exception. As thousands take to the streets to call for an end to the widespread police violence that claims Black lives, music is a constant companion. Protesters chant, "No justice, no peace, no racist police." The singing group Her sings, "I Can't Breathe." Janiquia Charles tells a security guard, "You about to lose your job," and creates a hashtag defund the police bop right there on the spot. This Black History Month, TV One debuts The Beat Don't Stop, a documentary that explores the roots and power of go-go, a music genre popularized by Washington, D.C. hometown hero Chuck Brown that quickly became the rhythmic voice of the Chocolate City. Executively produced by Kathy Hughes, it is filled with archival photos, footage of go-go's and the people who rock them. The film features the interviews with go-go pioneers, proponents, and historians, including Backyard Band, Dougie Fresh, and Angie Ainge. Here are the top three reasons to spend with this perfectly timed documentary. The music is fire. Even for those who only experience with go-go is EU's The Butt that was immortalized in Spike Lee's School Days, it is impossible to hear Chuck Brown and the Soul Searchers sit in the pocket and not be moved. It's a sound that's distinctly Black, driven by a bass line that stirs the body and the soul. This documentary traces the story of go-go from the first time Rare Essence's Tyrone, quote-unquote, Jungle Boogie Williams laid his hands on the congas, to the day when Maisha and the Hip Huggers showed us that women could move a crowd too. Next, the history is poignant. As Tone P of District Funk Records says in the film, Go-go is the indigenous music of DC, but the driving element, the drums, have roots that stretch back to Africa. The heartbeat they create has given us life for centuries, carrying us through the horrors of slavery, moving our feet in moments of progress. The connection isn't lost on Dr. Natalie Hopkinson's Howard University professor and author of Go-Go Live. Viewers get to experience Black joy, community, connection, and resilience. These are the characteristics that have allowed Black people to survive from slavery up until now, she says. The activism is instructive. For the last 25 years, it's been impossible to pass the corner of 7th Avenue and Florida Avenue Northwest in Washington, D.C., without hearing go-go played at danceable decibels. But in 2019, new white residents threatened lawsuits in an attempt to silence the music. The film documents how people held massive go-go's in the streets of the historically Black neighborhood as part of the Don't Mute D.C. campaign, co-created by Hopkinson and activist Ronald Moulton. The result was a major blow against gentrification. When you mix music with protest, it's a powerful sound that cannot be ignored. When you mix music with protest, it's a powerful sound that cannot be ignored. We were able to change policies in education, health, and culture, and there is no reason why we can't do the same on a national level, says Hopkinson. In a world that wants us to be colorblind, we are demanding to be seen in HD. The Beat Don't Stop premieres on TV One on June 21st at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The next article is titled, Ferguson Elects Its First Black First Woman Mayor. Ella Jones made history on Tuesday night, becoming the first Black and first woman to ever be elected as mayor in Ferguson, Missouri. Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of Ebony. We hope you have enjoyed it, and be sure to listen again next time. I am Avery Lewis, reading for the NC Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for the blind and print impaired audience. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call us at 919-832-5138. 919-832-5138. So long until next time.